Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we look at how marine robots are shaping our future. For over 30 years, James Billingham has developed small, high-performance autonomous underwater vehicles, or AUVs, resulting in a class of systems that are now widely used within the military, industry, and science communities. He's also spent decades on expeditions from the Arctic to the Antarctic to reveal how AUVs are changing how humans explore and work in the ocean. These robots endure crushing pressures, freezing waters, and total darkness, collecting data vital for climate science, offshore energy, aquaculture, archaeology, and more. His book is How Are Marine Robots Shaping Our Future? Welcome, Jim.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you, particularly given you're sitting in one of my favorite locations down there at Woods Hole.
Yeah. So I think some people may be surprised to learn that only about 25% of the ocean features are mapped in detail. And what we do know about deep ocean depths, we've learned from the help of these deep sea robots, but still so much to learn.
Yeah, you know, and that 25% number kind of hides a deeper truth, if you will, if I can pardon the horrible pun. But if you actually were to ask what fraction of the ocean we actually have mapped at the level of, say, Google Earth, right, you know, that we actually had a photo image of with that kind of resolution, you know, there you're down to like 0.003% or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, most of the ocean is still waiting to be discovered.
And in the book, you delve into the history of these marine robotics, and we certainly have come a long way technologically in a relatively short time. And you have been sort of at the forefront of a lot of this discovery. How did you first get involved?
Well, how did I first get involved? Wow, that is, of course, the obvious question and one I should be prepared for. It really revolved around, I think, sort of, for me, an intersection of three things. One is I grew up in a family that traveled a lot. You know, we lived mostly overseas. And so I definitely had sort of the exploration bug. And I think, you know, when I got my PhD, I had spent 3 years in a lab with no windows, 6 years really in a lab with no windows. And I was really looking for something that would get me out, you know, in the larger world. And then, you know, number two, I think like many of us in the field, I like getting in when the field is still very new, when kind of all the experts in the world will fit in, you know, one small conference room. And the early days of marine robotics were very much like that. And it was a very tight-knit community. So I spent a lot of time down at Woods Hole with folks like Al Bradley and Dana Yerger, and it was a very tight-knit community. And then I think the third thing is it really enabled scientific impact, right? So if you think about moving into a field, and I was working in superconductivity at the time, high T sub C superconductors had been discovered. So there were no shortage of job offers and a lot of opportunity, you know, startups. So there were a lot of interesting opportunities, but it had gone from a little, you know, interesting small science with, like I said, you know, a very small number of very committed folks working on it to this giant kind of circus.
Yeah.
And I looked across at the oceanographic space, and it looked more like what it had been before, you know, a smaller group of very committed people working very hard on important problems. And for me, that kind of made it very attractive.
Yeah. So much. I learned a lot reading this book. And I think everybody knows about the pressure, right, when you go down at the deep sea. But one of the things I never really thought about was light, color, and sound all behave differently underwater.
Yeah, it is a very different environment, right? And light, right, is just one of the things on the electromagnetic spectrum that is affected by seawater. Seawater is a conductor. We don't really kind of think about that, but it has enormous consequences. What it means is it means those radio waves that all of our drones in the air and our terrestrial robots rely on don't work underwater. So your GPS goes away, your Wi-Fi goes away, your mobile connectivity goes away right in the first couple of inches after that vehicle goes under the water. And so that means you have to solve all of those problems again from scratch.
Yeah.
How are you going to talk to them? How are they going to know where they are?
Yeah. I think Alvin is probably the most recognizable to many of us lay people, right? And you talk a little bit about the significance of Alvin. This was, I mean, we had had, you know, predecessors, sort of, but Alvin was a big deal.
Yeah. In multiple ways, right? So one of my early visits down to Woods Hole, there was a picnic. And I remember I had given a talk on my marine robots, and which I was very nervous about because I knew I was coming to the place with all the experts. At the time, I was up at MIT, and I ended up talking to Alvin at this picnic. And I was kind of struggling with, yeah, I think this technology is really important, but what's it going to be used for? And, you know, there was a bit of pushback of, well, why should we spend money on this? We have so many other things we should do. And he talked to me about the early days of Alvin. He said, you know, he had developed it really under Navy funding, and it became available for, you know, for science. And the big question really was from scientists was like, why do I need to go down to the seafloor in this underwater vehicle when I could just lower something off the side of the ship and grab a blob of mud and do that analysis on deck? I kind of don't need to go down there into a very murky, deep, dark environment. And it turned out that, in fact, Alvin was instrumental to probably among the most important discoveries of humankind, right? We literally, Alvin found new forms of life on the planet of Earth, right? You know, at these much talked about on your show, I'm sure, hydrothermal vents, where you have these chemosynthetic life forms with all kinds of implications for life in the universe, really, for life everywhere, and in effect, for how likely it is to find aliens in other places. It was one of the great discoveries of our time, and the reason that it happened was because people went from a simple temperature measurement out there on one ship, seeing an anomaly, to getting Alvin to go down with human eyes on the bottom, seeing this incredible new ecosystem and life forms on the bottom. So Alvin has been instrumental in effect helping us realize just how wonderful a place our planet is.
Yeah. There's a section in the book where you talk about so far sound fixing and ranging and its significance in the war effort in the 1940s. And you're right, this is a trend marine science followed in the second half of the 1900s. Many discoveries and innovations made by civilian scientists working under military funding enabled extraordinary leaps forward in our understanding of the ocean.
Yes. You know, I think during World War II, Woods Hole had a proud history, really, of contributing to our success at sea as a nation. And in fact, I always point to a little excerpt of a logbook from a submarine that sits in the port office over there on the dock, right? And it's the engineering duty officer is writing in the logbook that they've just escaped a depth charging that the submarine is badly damaged. They probably would have been sunk, except this guy, Alvin, told them about thermoclines and how sound traveled in the ocean. And he remembered that, and they brought the submarine to just under the thermocline where the Japanese ships couldn't detect them anymore, and they were able to creep away. And I always think about that. It's that sort of intersection of understanding the environment and being able to, in this case, you know, survive an incident like that, a depth charging at sea. And now you got to sort of think that as you come out of World War II, the submarine service was the junior service, right? They went into World War II as in effect, you know, they were going to be spotters for battleships, and they became the pointy tip of the spear. They did amazing things in the Pacific, incredible acts of bravery. And on the far side of that, there's a group of people who know that they are alive because these odd scientists at places like Woods Hole and Scripps understood the environment and were able to help them give that sort of understanding advantage. And it led to that, among other things, I have to believe just was a fundamental driver in why the Navy was so committed to basic research on the ocean, particularly through those decades of the Cold War.
Yeah.
And I benefited from that. You know, I don't talk about it in the book, but I ended up on a committee which was formed at the end of World War II to advise the Navy on science and technology. And it gave me a firsthand seat sort of watching that interplay. It's a very important one, and led to many, many benefits for the country outside of that strict scope of national defense.
Yeah. So you mentioned Alvin, which came in the 60s. Talk about ROVs and how they evolved in the 1970s and 80s.
Well, so I think that, again, this is kind of an interesting story. Like most of these technology stories, they kind of get born in multiple places at the same time, right? Arguably, one of the first big demonstrations of tethered vehicles was in helping with the recovery of the hydrogen bombs that were lost off of Spain. There was an aerial refueling accident, which led to an aircraft breaking up in midair and scattering bombs over the ocean and parts of Spain. And finding all of those hydrogen bombs and getting them out was part of what, for the Navy, really taught them the importance of having this deep submergence capability. Alvin was very much part of that. But also, this was the first time that ROVs really played an important role in a national event like that. And so the U.S. Navy became quite committed to remotely operated vehicles. So remotely operated vehicles, for your listeners, are vehicles which, in the deep ocean, these are usually vehicles that weigh several tons. And they're connected by a cable to a ship on the surface. And that cable might be sort of a little bit bigger in diameter than a garden hose. And it carries, these days, fiber optics and electrical conductors. So there's power and connectivity. And you can sort of, on the surface of the ship, or if the ship is connected back to land from land, you can actually control a robot in the deep ocean. And it has a lot of really useful capabilities compared to a human vehicle. Human vehicle, of course, you've got eyes and people on the bottom. We all know what the benefits of that are. It's kind of intuitive. But the robot can stay down continuously. You don't have to bring the people back up to the surface and, you know, for them to rest and to replenish the vehicle. The ROV can kind of stay down until the ship has to go home. So it turns out to be a very productive way to do work in the ocean and to do science in the ocean. And so now there's a number of them in use by the scientific community around the world.
And then we get to the untethered vehicles, right, which can do even more.
Yes. Well, I don't know more, right?
They're different all, jobs, I guess, right?
Yeah, they're all kind of arrows in our quiver, so to speak. What the AUVs, I think, the autonomous underwater vehicles do is they fill in sort of a missing niche, if you will, between the floats and drifters that are used in quite large numbers in the ocean. They sort of drift around, sending their data back. Very important part of our understanding of the ocean and its circulation and its temperature, composition, at depth. But not really so suited for understanding sort of finer scale processes in the ocean, which turned out to be particularly important as you get near to the edge of the continents, where currents are, where you have things like the Gulf Stream, or if you want to understand biology. And so these autonomous underwater vehicles begin to sort of give you a capability to be out there in the ocean, making measurements kind of similar to what you would make from a ship. But be there almost all the time. They also may turn out to be very good seafloor mapping platforms. Mm. So they're not cabled to the surface, so they're more stable, they're more controllable, and they can carry a very high performance sonar and produce spectacular maps. So, down the hall from, down the road from you, there's a number of different groups that run these mapping vehicles and have found all kinds of wrecks and done all kinds of important recoveries in terms of helping on national problems, but from a scientific sense are contributing to finally filling in that 0.003% of the seafloor that we've actually seen.
We're talking about how are marine robots shaping our future. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break.
Bruce Stickrott, pilot of the Alvin, Woods Hole Oceanographic's deep sea submersible.
During my training as a pit dive, I was with our expedition leader. And normally the way it works is after you get time in the submarine, you're the guy that drives the submarine as a trainee, and the pilot sits behind you and observes what you're doing. And so if he starts to carry on and get mad and yell, you're worried. And Pat was behind me, and he was complaining. He was using some colorful terms. And I thought he was upset at the work I was doing. And when I turned around, what he was really angry about was there were no chocolate chip cookies in his lunch. And he had specifically taken a few of them aside and placed them in the refrigerator on the galley. Things have different importance. Chocolate chip cookie at the bottom of the ocean is worth much more than a chocolate chip cookie up here.
You're listening to CAI, local public radio for the Cape, Coast, and Islands, online at capeandislands.org.
You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about marine robots with James Bellingham, who's author of How Are Marine Robots Shaping Our Future? Also joining us now is Gwyneth Packard. She's senior engineering working on autonomous underwater systems at Woods Hole Oceanographic. Hi, Gwyneth.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
All right. So Jim just mentioned down the road. You're in those labs down the road, right? So talk a little bit about what you do as a senior engineer and roboticist. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, for me, it means bringing my software experience and my previous oceanographic experience to the lab to write behaviors for these autonomous underwater vehicles, these vehicles where we load up all of the energy and decision-making, unplug them, and send them off to do their thing. And additionally, I am the head of a team of seven software engineers now. When our lab started, Jim had talked earlier about how small the field was, and the founding members of our lab, the Oceanographic Systems Lab, for the REMUS vehicle, there was one software engineer doing all of that work at the time, right, at the beginning of the field. There are seven of us now carrying on that work. And so I lead that team. I still write some code, but mostly architecting and collaborating with scientists.
So what was your path to robotics?
Oh, it was a spiral. It was nonlinear. Like Jim, I started out in physics, and I was in high energy physics at the beginning. And again, I was very dissatisfied with having the experience as a young undergrad in college of having 120 people working for 10 years to add the 18th decimal place to the weight of a subatomic particle. I really just wanted to be closer and get my hands in. And what I love about this field, in addition to all of the ocean exploration and everything that we do being in service of understanding that planetary system, is also being around for the entire cycle of seeing something become real.
Yeah. Jim, I wonder if you talk about why deep sea exploration is so important. We talked about mapping, but it's more than just mapping, right?
Yeah. So first of all, hi, Gwyneth. Great to see you again.
Likewise.
So, So why is it so important? Well, there's a couple of different angles on this, right? You know, one angle really revolves around the fact that the ocean is the largest and arguably least well understood part of our climate system. So if you want to understand our climate trajectory, you have to understand the ocean, not just the ocean, but the biology in the ocean, because they're a key part of the Earth's carbon cycle. They really sort of determine, in effect, the distribution of chemicals on the planet. And by the way, we hardly understand them at all. But in another more practical sense, you know, we have a chapter in the book with the ocean in our kitchen, in which we kind of talk about all the different ways in which the ocean shows up in people's lives that they might not realize. You know, the food that they eat, of course, you know, there's wild fisheries. We're all familiar with that. But people may not realize that roughly half of the fish they consume are farmed. So increasingly, we're transforming the ocean. We're moving to this. We're moving from hunter-gatherer to farming in the ocean, you know, about, you know, 10 millennia after we did it on land. And then there's electricity coming out of your socket, which is coming from wind farms, or we hope is coming from wind farms. And that's another place where the ocean, particularly if you're in Europe, has a very large impact. You know, your kitchen has lots of plastic. Those plastics are mostly petroleum products. And that oil comes increasingly from the ocean as well. The highest producing oil wells are offshore. And then when you make a telephone call or when you communicate with someone over the internet, if they're on another continent, those electrical signals go through cables which are on the seafloor. So the seafloor literally connects us in an electronic sense. And of course, when you buy products which are made in Asia or in Europe, those were typically shipped to you via ships which travel over the ocean. So it's the gateway, if you will, to the other continents, and increasingly the provider of resources which are central to our prosperity and our civilization.
And we can talk also about the connectedness, as he just mentioned, and the seafloor. Some of our safety is involved in finding out about the seismic activity on the seafloor, particularly in trenches, for example, near places that seismic activity can cause tsunamis.
Didn't mention medicine. We also get medicine, right? That's a big
medicine. I didn't mention hurricanes. Yeah. I mean, you know,
oxygen.
I just want to grab the mic and hold it.
When you're talking about the kitchen, one of the things I found really interesting in the book is you talk when you're talking about aquaculture, and you talk about, you know, examples, challenges. Tell us about the cobia being raised off the coast of Panama. I thought this was really interesting. This isn't it's fish farming, but it's like out offshore.
Well, so one of the things that happens, right, when you start a new industry is you have a lot of lessons to learn. And again, aquaculture is really, you know, you could argue about how old it is, but maybe 100 years old or something like that. And we do know that there are impacts of aquaculture on the environment. And one of the things that we're learning is how to mitigate those impacts. How do you do aquaculture in a sustainable way, which is environmentally friendly? And one of the things that you really don't want to do is concentrate a lot of animals in a very small area. And that's what happens, right, when you do things like use the fjords of Norway for salmon farming. And I spend a bit of time in Norway, and so I just came back from there a few weeks ago, and they're very concerned about the concentration of sea life, lice, a parasite, which affects the health of salmon there. And that occurs because you have all of these salmon in those fjords. And so one farm gets infested and it spreads to other farms. But if you can push that offshore to the larger part of the ocean, right, where you have a less confined environment, you have the opportunity to, number one, provide sort of a healthier environment potentially for your fish, right? But also make sure that, you know, the byproducts, the waste byproducts are not sort of concentrated in those otherwise very precious areas. So I think that these are things that we really, you know, need to think about, right, as we develop these aquaculture systems. And so that farm off of Panama has been kind of a proving ground for technologies that would operate offshore. And if you operate offshore, one of the problems you have is it can be very rough there. And so your farm can't sort of be on the surface all the time. It'll just get torn up. You have to be able to pull it under the surface. And so that's a big focus of this organization, Innovacy, that I've been an advisor to for many years, which is focused on how do you enable offshore aquaculture.
Yeah. And we could probably do a whole show on the pros and cons of deep sea mining, but that's another area where we really need to know more, right? I mean, there's lots of interest in this area, but the consequences could be really bad. We don't know enough.
Well, so like so many of these things, right? You know, we are very good at exploiting our environment, and our ability to exploit it usually runs ahead of our understanding of it. The ocean is no exception to that. So I think, you know, one of the things that it becomes very clear when you look at sort of specific cases, like, for example, Deepwater Horizon, where you have a group of first responders going in needing to decide, you know, should we use surfactants or not? The science hasn't really been hasn't been done yet. Mm-hmm. And so we'd really kind of like to do the science before we have any catastrophes. And number one, make sure we don't have a catastrophe. But number two, if we do, have the science to know how to handle it.
Yeah. Since you mentioned Deepwater Horizon, I wanted to play off that. But you also talk about, you know, that's in an area where we're likely to see a spill, right? But someplace like the Arctic, we could have really a lot of damage before we'd even notice something. So this is where some of those AUVs would come in handy, right?
And oh, I had a great project there. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that the Remus vehicle has been working under the ice, and that's a whole host of problems itself. You know, you have AUVs trying to figure out how not to run into the bottom. Now you have to also not run into the ceiling and to find your way home to the hole in the ice. So in addition to the engineering problems, then conquering those enough to be able to address the scientific problems that you want to look at there.
Yeah. Jim, go ahead.
So I agree. You know, the Arctic is a special place. I have a great deal of interest in the Arctic, both for climate reasons and also because there is increasing human activity up there. We did a project when I was at Woods Hole. We had a project there to use a long endurance vehicle as a first responder for the Coast Guard should a ship run aground in the Arctic. And so we developed a system and actually tested it up in Maine. It we called it sort of the last seat in the helicopter project, because the idea was unlike Deepwater Horizon, where you were sort of a day's steam out of several ports with all of these ships and deep ocean capability. In the Arctic, you're going to be very far from your logistics bases. So the big question is, how the heck do you get stuff out there to understand what's going on? And there are, and right now there's a ship stuck up there right now in the Arctic. It ran aground, and they've been sort of anxiously trying to figure out how to get it unstuck and out of there before winter sets in and it potentially gets crushed. Mm-hmm. So these are the risks you run operating an environment where the maps are terrible. Some of them are done literally with lead lines. So the people that you would turn to for rescue are thousands of miles away, and at best can get there with a helicopter that can carry a few people. So it's a big issue.
Yeah, we talk about logistics, and we were just talking about a project the other day and talking about whether there was funding to do the duration that they wanted to. And I said, well, what if we cut it? And they said, well, there's only one plane a week.
Limits your ability. So when I talk about the collaboration with scientists driving innovation robotics, for example, what were some of the questions scientists were hoping to answer that shaped the design or operation of underwater robotics?
So what we do with the underwater robotics is collect data that couldn't be collected any other way. And, you know, instead of being tied to a ship that moves 15 nautical miles and then lowers a package for the day and brings it back and then moves another 15 miles, right? With all those people and all that expense, you can now send a tool to do profiles, to identify features, to map. And so everything that we do has to be motivated by what are you trying to look at? What are you trying to get? And so we're always talking to scientists in biology, in chemistry, in physical oceanography about, you know, what waveforms are you looking at? How often are they occurring? You know, things driven by the tidal cycle, for example. And we can go out and examine those. Some of it's naval, right? The Navy is still heavily investing in us in ways that then are leveraged for basic science, and they're happy about that. The Navy loves when one of the things that has been developed to help them, for example, clear a beach of mines, instead of having divers in the surf zone with explosives, you can now send this robot in. And then some of the technology that comes out of that can then help another scientist go out and collect environmental DNA somewhere else, right? One of our favorite projects, right, the Shark Cam, came from a biologist chatting with me in the coffee obsession line about, you know, I've always wanted to know what they're doing there, right? Because you can tag whales and they come up to breathe. You can tag sharks, but they don't have to come up to breathe, right? Yeah. And so you have some less tag data that way. And
so you're having coffee. This biologist says this to you, and then you walk away. You go, huh?
I think we can do that. How can we do that? We can make this happen.
We can make that happen. That's so funny. Setbacks, of course, can be challenging in the moment, but they can also be a path to innovation, right? Can you share a moment when something failed, but the experience helped shape a future success?
Honestly, it's too broad a set of memories to pull one. But basically, we do what we call spiral development. And so our slogan is fail early, fail often, right? Mm-hmm. And so you... you do your best to identify all of the edge cases to bound the problem as best your imagination can, and then you run some simulations and you test it more on the bench, but there's no substitute for putting it in the actual ocean and seeing what nature's going to throw at you. Yeah. And it always surprises us. And
it's so interesting, too, because, I mean, isn't that science? You go into something with a question or a set of questions, and you may or may not find the answers to that, but it might send you in a different direction.
Absolutely.
And you find something, you're like, whoa, that wasn't what I... Like the whole thing with the hydrothermal vents.
Absolutely.
Who knew we were going to find life there, right?
Right?
That was a big surprise.
And find life that didn't require sunlight, and find life that is carrying red blood cells just like us, but then actually carrying a gas that's toxic to us instead of oxygen. I mean, we do as best we can to know what we don't know, but we still, there are still so many mysteries,
yeah.
So much we don't know.
All right, so where do you test the prototypes locally?
Everywhere. So you'll see us off the dock all the time. I actually was just coming in today behind a truck carrying one of our vehicles, and you'll sometimes see us wheeling our vehicles down the street to the dock at the park. We test in local waters, sometimes just off the dock, sometimes in ponds, mm-hmm. because especially with our new vehicle. So our lab, Oceanographic Systems Lab, is currently developing the Phoenix, which is the next generation. Mm-hmm. And it's a more modular, more open system, so a lot more collaboration, a lower bar for people to contribute code to it. And we, with a new vehicle like that, a brand new system, if things went wrong, we didn't want to have to chase it all the way to Rhode Island, right? So we put it in one of the ponds.
Yeah.
So,
and Jim, you have a story in the book where you did some testing at Lake Winnipesaukee, which was a fun story.
Yeah, well, Lake Winnipesaukee for me was a bit of a Hail Mary. We had this project where we were supposed to be preparing for an ice camp. And for us, it was really only going to be our second field program as a laboratory. This is back in 92, 93, I guess, and 93, 94, excuse me. And we had a set of challenges, which really revolved around the fact that our money from ONR had kind of showed up at the last minute. So we were very late to the party in terms of building the vehicle. We'd never been to an ice camp before, so we wanted to go up to Winnipesaukee and get some experience running vehicles under ice. And we had a final test that we were going to run before shipping the vehicle to the Arctic. And it wandered off and basically stopped under ice. And it was all because I got a little too clever. As the vehicle came back, it was supposed to home in on a net. It had hit the net every time. So I said, well, we have a recovery behavior, and the recovery behavior should save us, right, if it doesn't hit the net. And we've never tested that. So we pulled the net. The vehicle zips by, but when we pulled the net, we didn't pull the transponder. So it actually thinks it successfully docked. So it actually shuts down, drifts off under ice. And now I've got a vehicle stuck under ice. The sun is setting. You know, the moving van is waiting for us to sort of take everything back down to the Institute and pack it up. And how are we going to get it back? And we did, in fact, manage to drill a hole into the ice, connect to it, and get it going again, and drive it back to the ice hole. It was one of these things where it's very cold out. And so we have our laptop connected to the vehicle through the ice. And as I'm typing, the cold weather is causing the screen of the laptop to die. So it's literally fading. And I'm trying to get all of the things into the vehicle before I completely lose the ability to see what I'm typing on the screen. Yeah. It did, in fact, we got the vehicle off and we got it back to the ice hole. And we ended up getting it up to the Arctic. So it all worked out well, but it really was one of these things that that kind of felt like everything was sort of working against you and you were
That happens. We're talking about how marine robots are shaping our future. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with James Bellingham. He's the executive director of the John Hopkins Institute for Assured Autonomy and the Bloomberg Distinguished Professor of Exploration Robotics and the author of How Are Marine Robots Shaping Our Future? Also with us is Gwyneth Packard. She's senior engineering working on autonomous underwater systems at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, look into the future. Jim, one of the things that's so fascinating about what we're doing here and in our exploration in the deep sea is this is very applicable to space exploration.
Yes, I find that the space robotics community are kind of kindred spirits. You know, one of the attractions of working at Johns Hopkins is right down the road from me. Actually, I have an appointment there is the Applied Physics Lab. And they flew that DART mission where they hit an asteroid to deflect an asteroid. They're sending a helicopter to one of the moons of Saturn, to Titan. They have currently a set of missions flying right now, including IMAP. So this whole business in the ocean where we figured out that we had to do autonomy actually several decades ago, really, in the space, ironically, you know, with much more money, they're really only beginning to cross that chasm now because their connectivity is so much better than ours, right? You have better connectivity to a spacecraft on the surface of Mars than you do to a robot at the bottom of the ocean. So they have a lot of tools that we don't have in that environment. And so there's a lot of back and forth, right? They have a lot of money, they have a lot of creativity, and they do some very, very exciting missions. But, you know, we are forced to do autonomy. So we think about that all the time, like Gwyneth, right? Mm-hmm. Leading her team of people, right? Developing all of these capabilities. And where they're sort of very reluctant to put autonomy on a spacecraft, Gwyneth is thinking about how to enable users to put their autonomy on her robot. So
as Jim had talked about earlier, there are so many challenges with communication and navigation in the ocean because you don't have your GPS, you don't have your cell phone, you don't have Wi-Fi. And so how can you think of that example of a swimmer trying to swim across the river, but the current is taking them down. Well, they can look around and say, here's where I actually am. I'm meant to be at this point and I'm downstream. But with us, we go into the ocean, and if the vehicle's in midwater column, what reference does it have to say that a current has pushed me away from where the user at the surface thinks I am in planetary coordinates, right? And so we have to figure out where we are. If you have several vehicles, how do they talk to each other? If they're supposed to be collecting data for the user, how do they get it back? Do they have to come to the surface? And so all of that remote behavior is our bread and butter and what we are thinking about all the time.
Yeah. And Jim, you talk about this in the book, how these marine robots may help with discoveries across the solar system. And I guess back to the hydrothermal vents, our discovery of life around hydrothermal vents has really changed what we thought about where life is possible.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things which suddenly click inside of you, and sometimes you know them for a while, and then you look at them in a different way, and they sort of change how you kind of, in a way, look at the world. And for me, this happened when I was at Woods Hole, when we started working on ocean worlds, and so the basic story is that in the late 70s, we had two world-shaking discoveries, right? One was we found the hydrothermal vents, and the other, and I say we, the community, right, found hydrothermal vents. And then the other was we discovered that there were oceans on the icy moons orbiting the gas giants in the outer solar system. And as we learned more and more about these icy moons, we realized that there was a lot of ocean there. As a matter of fact, more ocean there than there is on our planet. And it changes fundamental assumptions of where you go to find life, because at the bottom of those icy oceans, presumably, are very active inner cores, right? We know that they're active because you can look at other moons there and you can see a lot of volcanism. So there ought to be hydrothermal vents there. So just like hydrothermal vents on Earth have their own strange forms of life, there seems to be a reasonable chance that with all of these moons in the outer solar system, that at least one of them might have life down there living around hydrothermal vents in, you know, orbiting around Jupiter or Saturn or Neptune, or maybe, you know, even, you know, Pluto might even have oceans.
And it's so exciting to think about that. But then you go, one of the big challenges, that ice is pretty darn thick, right? Miles thick.
Yeah. So true. So this is, and not only that, you know, in the case of like Europa, which was the, you know, the first moon where we really had this appreciation for it, it's in a very high radiation environment around Jupiter. So, so if you put something down there on the surface of Europa to drill down through that 5 kilometers, 10 kilometers, who knows, you know, it's a lot of ice you got to get through to get down to that ocean. How long are you going to survive there on the surface in that high radiation environment? So these are really big technical challenges that are facing the next generation of scientists, right? Of space scientists, and ultimately those space scientists hopefully give us ocean scientists a ride to those great oceans in the outer solar system, and we get to do our magic there. So it's very exciting times.
Yes. Teamwork.
Yeah, right. And I had a question, Jim, about the if we have any idea about how quickly that ice would close. Because, you know, that's been a surprise for people up in the Arctic sometimes. You make your hole, you put your vehicle in, and now all of a sudden you're in a fight that you didn't know you were going to be in to keep that hole open. And so I wonder if we have any estimation of how it would behave.
Well, we know, I mean, one of the clues, right, that there was an ocean there had to do with the fact that there were really no craters on Europa, right? So, you know, anything that's sitting out there in the solar system should have a lot of craters on it. You know, Earth doesn't have so many craters because they get weathered away, but the moon has a lot. Europa, not so much, right? And that is telling you it's getting resurfaced all the time. And we know that there are basically geysers, right, which shoot water from that ocean, you know, tens of kilometers, hundreds of kilometers, perhaps, into space. So we know that there are times when that ocean is open to the vacuum above. And so could we take advantage of that? You know, those are what you're getting at. You know, those are all really interesting questions. Mm-hmm. And that would take one heck of a clever robot, I will say.
Or several.
Yeah. Does your work require you to go to sea to operate the robots? And if so, is that a part you enjoy? Or can you stay here?
Well, you can do both. So if people are looking into the career and what it entails, they're both possible. There are people who stay in the lab strictly, but there are people who go out. We have technicians who are out all the time. I have had the opportunity to go out sometimes with robots. I went out much more in my past life as a physical oceanographer. But yes, we take them also to the field. So we've used them to survey the Delaware Aqueduct for the New York City water supply. So putting our vehicles into tunnels, I was able to go on a trip that was examining a intake for a foundry in Scotland. So I got to go to the Highlands with our vehicles. But we've also taken them out into the basin, out to where the Pioneer Array has been offshore, and I got to go on that cruise. So I have been on our ships, and I adore that. That is a highlight of the career.
Jim, what are your thoughts on what the future may look like? Instead of like these individual robots, you maybe see them working in teams?
Yeah, I think as we kind of alluded to earlier, there's no one robot.
He's fading in and out there. So Gwyneth, go ahead. Why don't you answer that? There'll probably be teams in the future?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there are constantly innovations on how we're going to have them coordinate. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, what kind of model you're going to have for these swarms. Are they going to swarm where everyone has their own same agency, like a flock of birds? Or are you going to have a sort of sheepdog, sheep herd sort of situation where you have a leader and a bunch of followers? Are you going to have them going to something or away from something? So there are a lot of dynamics, a lot of problems to solve. But the one of the huge problems is, how will they know where each other are? As you talk about how sound is absorbed in the ocean, how light is absorbed in the ocean, all of these things
lots
that we count
of
on here.
Yes. Yeah. What are you working on right now?
The Phoenix Project.
Right.
Yeah, taking that to its next steps, and the team is super excited about that. Yeah.
When is that expected to kind of be revealed?
So we've already gotten our prototype working. We've already collected sonar data to show that this is a viable system, and we are just going to continue taking the parts of the old system apart into what we call modules. So making it more modular.
Yeah.
So that, for example, somebody could come in and say, you know, I think I can do task C in a new way. Can I move your task C and put mine in? Right now, that's bringing in a new task C is akin to brain surgery. How do you plug it all into the system, right? But then it would be more like Legos. Yeah, take our C block out and put your C block in.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Jim, what do you hope people take away from the book?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, that we have a much more intimate relationship with the ocean than they might have realized when they started the book. So I think you know, an appreciation for how important the ocean is in all of our lives. And also, I kind of want people to get a sense for the excitement of this ocean enterprise. You know, I think my colleagues in the ocean sciences have just phenomenal stories to tell, right? I mean, kind of every cruise is its own kind of adventure. And so I think celebrating that and telling people about some of the, you know, great, you know, intellectual challenges people are taking on in this very hostile environment and the clever things that people are doing, right, to get at those tough problems is a story that really I find super exciting. I mean, it kind of gets me up every day.
Yeah, it's a really exciting time. And so Gwyneth, what advice do you have for students who have this interest in robotics?
Stay curious. I always say, you know, I described my career path before, and it's a pivot, right? My career path was just what's next and what's out there. And that really drove me, and it still drives me, what is next in understanding our oceans, right? And so our society, our school system, not everything is geared toward keeping people curious. So guard your curiosity.
Oh, I love that.
It's precious.
And are there opportunities for Cape and Islands students to learn more about the underwater robotics program at HUI?
Absolutely. And if you go to whoi.edu, right on that homepage, you're going to see a tab for what we do. If you look under there, you'll see opportunities for everything from K through 12 through undergrad and graduate. We also have tours, so there's opportunities for adults to come and look at the Discovery Center. And also for people anywhere who want to just know more, on that same tab on whoi.edu, there's an ocean learning hub where you can find incredible stories about all the work being done at the institution.
Yeah. Got about a minute and a half left. Jim, some final thoughts from you?
Well, I think one of the things that it's worth mentioning is that there is a timer running. You know, changes are occurring quickly in the ocean, you know, particularly at high latitudes in the Arctic. And not only that, but all of these tools that we're developing are being applied both for understanding the ocean. I mean, that's kind of where a lot of the robots that are out there now had their genesis, was really in the ocean sciences. But they're being used for a variety of other applications. And so we really as a society need to not put this off. We need to take understanding the ocean seriously. And we need to actually do that not only because it's interesting science, which it most definitely is, but because it actually matters, right? In effect, our prosperity as a society depends on how well we understand the ocean and how responsibly we use it.
All right. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. James Bellingham is the executive director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Assured Autonomy and the author of How Are Marine Robots Shaping Our Future? Thank you, Jim, for being here. And Gwyneth Packard, senior engineering working on autonomous underwater systems at HUI. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.